Well, it is Wednesday, April 11th, 2012. I am Jack Fox, and I'm sitting here with one of the legends of broadcasting in Kentucky, and certainly WHAS, Van Vance. How you doing, Van?
Doing great, Jack. You've invited me here to talk about working at WHAS.
You were WHAS nothing, for how many years?
42 years.
42
there's nothing, years. Nothing more pleasant than remembering my years at WHAS.
What was your last year there? When did you leave then?
I left 99. I retired full time.
So that means you came, what year you came in
1957, actually, when I started.
Well, now, let's talk to you. Just first of all, you're not from Louisville. Where are you from?
Well, I was born in the Park City Mammoth Cave area. I tell people I was born in a cave because that land down there is full of caverns underneath.
Oh, yeah,
and you might have a field one day and have a corn crop, and the next day it would be a hole in the ground.
But were you from a farm or?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm about 2 miles from Park City, and then when I was about 13 or 14, I lived with my aunt. She was my counselor and guidance counselor. I lived with her and about 2.5 miles out in the country.
That's a long way from doing a Final Four in the Superdome in New Orleans.
Yeah, and the amazing thing, when I was a freshman in high school, I was a starting guard on the second team, we call it. It was the JV team.
At Park City High School.
And when I would play, I didn't have a ride to the games at Park City. It's about 2 and 2.5 miles to show you how you would get in shape in those days and how you were excited about playing basketball. Sometimes I would run the 2 and 2.5 miles to Park City and then play in the gym that night, or if I had to catch the bus to go to an away game. And I never got tired. I went and played a full game.
Wow, and then had to walk or run home.
Well,
did you run home or did you?
Believe it or not, I usually got a ride home, especially if I had a good game.
Now, how tall are you, Van?
I'm about 6'2".
And that was you were pretty tall back then at that time, weren't you?
Right, and handled the ball pretty well.
You could have even played center back then.
Yeah, I did play center a lot. And I led the fast break. But I was known as Van Hawkeye Vance when I was high school.
Because you're a good shooter?
Yeah, I scored 22 points a game my last 2 years in high school. I was pretty well known in what was then the 5th region. And what happened is, of all of my achievements in basketball, my high point night was 39 one night. And then I kind of brag about this because of a career of playing and covering basketball. And actually, in latter years, seeing men who were making over $1 million a year could not hit a free throw. One night I made 34 points, and I brag about this a little bit. I'm not modest about this. I made 34 points. I had 18 free throws and hit all 18 of them in the game.
Wow.
Which I'm rather proud of.
Well, if you calculate that into today's dollars, we'd be doing this in the Cayman Islands today, wouldn't we?
Right. And I did not. They did not have the bonus then. If they'd had the bonus, I would have had a real big scoring night. But anyhow, what happened to me is I played basketball, and my final game was at Allen County High School, and we lost to Glasgow. And the man who was broadcasting for WKAY in Glasgow was a man by the name of Jack Eversoll, who was from Louisville, had attended the University of Kentucky and came back to Glasgow and was the manager of the station. So I'm very disappointed. I'm in the dressing room after the game. My career is over. I had been recruited by a lot of colleges and had a chance to go and play basketball at several places, Kentucky Wesleyan, Tennessee Tech. Louisville wanted me to come and try out. Western was interested in Lindsey Wilson, a junior college, and Columbia, a junior college, or another junior college. I know Lindsey Wilson was one of them. But anyhow, Jack Eversoll came to the dressing room and said, you know, Van, you entered that I Speak for Democracy contest, and you came to our radio station and recorded that speech. At that time I was about 17, 18 years old, had about the same voice that I have now, believe it or not. And the day that I recorded that speech, all of the contestants from the Barron County High Schools were in the studio. And I noticed some older men looking through the window, big picture window with a big microphone, when I started reading my speech.
I heard that voice.
And so he said, "We heard your speech, and we think you should be in radio. Are you interested?" And I said, "Yes."
Had you thought about it before at that point?
No, I did play-by-play a lot. Sometimes when I was playing basketball myself or with the guys, I would recreate games that I'd heard on the radio of Western games, U of L,
so
or Kentucky.
To the radio then
I was a big radio fan, and I listened to music. So he said, "Will you come to the radio station in Glasgow next week, and we'll talk about it, and we'll start you out." So I did. I started on Sundays, playing music, introducing ministers on Sunday morning, and reading baseball scores, and that began my career. Well, I enrolled at Western Kentucky University, and I was driving all the way from Park City to Bowling Green back to Glasgow. Quite a trip, busy young man. And Mr. Eversole got a job at WKCT in Bowling Green and eventually had me transfer down there with him. That way I didn't have to drive, so I lived in Bowling Green. I was walking in the radio station at Bowling Green, WKCT, owned by the Park City Daily newspaper, and a car pulls up, and it's Uncle Ed Diddle. And one of his players was chauffeuring him. Yeah, he was a famous coach of the Western Hilltoppers, a man with a red towel. And he said, "Vance, come over here. I want to talk to you. What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going to work." And he said, "You don't have to work to go to school. You can come up and play on my basketball team." And I said, "No, I like my radio work." It had become, I tell people now, I wasn't going to be another Dr. J and that I better get a career. And that's the great thing about Jack Eversole. He didn't just give me a job, he gave me a career.
Wow, that's quite a statement. Yeah,
that's for young people or for anybody who's thinking about getting a job. When you're young, try to go into something that's going to give you a career.
Yeah, and he was a mentor to you then.
Oh, he was. It's unbelievable what he did for me.
It
paved my life ahead for me. Wow. So anyhow, he said, "You come up." Mr. Diddle had had a heart attack, and he'd been to Florida, and Ted Hornback was coaching the team. So he was rather inactive, although he was still the head coach.
But he knew about you from your playing days then?
He sure did, yeah. He and a man who recruited a lot for him, Big Six Henderson, had recruited me some. So I went up, and he said, "You can play on the team, and then when you have to go to work, you go ahead and go to your basketball practice, and everything will be okay." So I played my freshman year the second semester. You could not play in the games. It was illegal for a freshman to play at that time. They were not eligible.
No one had done
it. Right. So anyhow, when I completed that year, we talked it over, and I said, "You know, I don't think I'm going to play that much." And he said, "I'm going to need your room," and we came to an agreement. So I went to Lebanon, Kentucky, and worked with a couple of friends that I had known at Glasgow who had started their own station. I worked there a month or two and then transferred to the University of Kentucky and auditioned and landed a job at WVLK in Lexington. I also became the backup sportscaster to Claude Sullivan, who was a well-known broadcaster in Kentucky.
He did the UK games.
He sure did. He had the Standard Oil University of Kentucky network. Later became the voice of the Cincinnati Reds. But anyhow, about 1957, I sent an audition to George Walsh at WHAS in Louisville. They had an opening as an announcer or a sportscaster. And I wound up getting the job as a backup sportscaster and a full-time announcer.
Did you have to do an audition? What was your audition like?
I did an audition. I sent a tape. And they called me in person. And there were three key men involved in WHAS operation at the Courier-Journal building. Radio.
Well, they were still at 6th and Chestnut then.
Yeah. Radio was on the fifth floor. I'm sorry, the offices and the cafeteria were on the fifth floor, and the radio studios were on the sixth floor, and television was on the seventh floor. So I came to WHAS, and three men auditioned me in person: Sam Gifford, Paul Clark, who was the chief of announcers at WHAS, and George Walsh, who was the program director and was still doing a lot of sports. George Walsh had been the broadcaster of the Philadelphia Phillies baseball team in the National League when he was in Philadelphia and was one of the top broadcasters play-by-play in the major leagues.
I didn't realize that.
No doubt about that, yep. And he left that job and came on to WHAS radio to be a sportscaster. He did UK basketball and football. When they wanted to move him upstairs, they made him program director, and then they hired Kaywood Ledford to come in and do play-by-play. George still did the football for two or three years after Kaywood came here, but Kaywood took over the basketball. So anyhow, what happens is George Walsh was a key man in my development at WHAS. He kind of became my supervisor and my mentor. And they hired me, and I came here as an announcer.
In 1957.
June 1957. On the first day, I rode the elevator up to the sixth floor to report in for work, and I had to do a television audition for them at that time. Phyllis Knight and Sam Gifford were Phyllis and Sam Gifford. They got on the elevator with me, and they had just come back from their honeymoon.
Oh, wow.
And it was their first day back at work.
Wow, two strong influences at WHAS in those days.
At that time, WHAS had 9 men on the announce staff, and Paul Clark was the chief announcer. He made out the schedule for both radio and television. On that announce staff were legends: Jim Walton, Sam Allgood, Ray Shelton, Bill Britton, Milton Metz. They used Cactus Tom Brooks.
Sure. Uh-huh.
He had to put his teeth in when he did the announcing. But and also a man named Bob Lawson. I think I've included most of them.
Wow,
or all of them.
That's a strong lineup.
Yeah, it was really, and a lot of them not only were announcers, they were personalities.
What was the program day like? What would make up a program?
Well, WHAS radio at that time was really a high level operation. I would say it was heavily news. They had soap operas.
Mm-hmm.
Were still on the air.
Sure.
At that time. I don't remember the name of them, but they were famous, mm-hmm. a lot of them. Helen Trent or something,
sure.
All of those famous. But WHAS was, in the morning, they had the country music on. Shorty Chesser had a radio show for an hour. Then we would have a lot of news, and then Randy Atcher and the group sometimes would be on for a few minutes. And then Jim Walton hosted a Funfair PM, which had its own live combo. And live
it was on
singer.
Afternoons or evenings?
No, it was on in the morning,
in the
Funfair
morning.
AM.
Okay.
Or just called it Funfair at that time. So then HAS would go through the day with more soap operas after the noon news and farm. Barney Arnold was a big guy with
sure.
with 30 minutes of farm broadcasting.
With the 50,000
right.
signal that got
better
out.
Believe it. And then in the afternoon, they'd have a few more soap operas. And then they had an afternoon music show. Tiny Thomail, a piano player, did that. And then
it was live then.
Right, yeah. And then, but he played records
yeah.
also.
Oh, he played records too.
Yeah, okay. And then in the evening, you talk about a strong news and documentary type lineup. At 5:45, Lowell Thomas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then at 6:45, Edward R. Murrow. Then at 7 o'clock, Douglas Edwards and The World Tonight, a 30-minute news
wow.
program
wow.
with all of that Murrow,
sure.
those famous reporters, Hotlit,
yeah.
All of the most famous of the CBS, Severide and people in
wow.
Cronkite,
wow.
people like that
wow.
would be featured. And then early on, Milton Metz, they put him on Juniper 52385 or whatever the name of that program. Later it became Metz here. And then a lot of times I would do an 11 to midnight show, which was called Music for Tonight. And you would come on, the night is old, the night is young, the moon is made of music. And then you'd play about 15 minutes of music, real nice, smooth music. And
did you select the music?
No, it was done by, we had a full-time record library staff. Mm-hmm. And at the time I first went to HAS, they selected all of the music.
Really? Mm-hmm.
So that was the first phase of my being at WHAS Radio. And of
course, what were your other duties did you have in addition to that program? As an announcer, what did you do?
I read some news. I did commercials on the news. I did commercials at 10:15 at night. They had the 10 o'clock news with Pete French, who was the biggest name in news on radio and television mm-hmm. in Louisville when I arrived. Pete French okay. was a legendary newscaster.
Okay.
And then at 10:15, Kaywood usually did the sports at that time. And I did the commercials, did the announcing on those shows.
Did you do breaks like in the soap operas?
Do you think yeah, I would do station breaks. Yeah, yeah. And then I read some newscasts, the shorter 5 minutes on a half hour type newscast.
Let me ask you one other question. You talk about all these legendary people there. What was the, did you all interact, or were your shifts so different you didn't see other people? There was a lot of camaraderie between all the announce staff? And
I had an unusual shift. I started out, I was the junior member.
Yeah.
I started out signing on the station. The station signed off at 12:05.
Okay.
My first day to work sometimes was like on a Tuesday or something. I'd sign on the station at 5 o'clock in the morning. And on my fifth day of work, I would sign off the station at 12:05 at night.
What did the sign on and sign off consist of? Did you have to read something?
Or? Yeah, this is WHAS, owned and operated 50,000 yeah, okay. watts, Clear Channel 1A, owned and operated by the Courier Journal, Louisville Times, the Bingham Corporation, all that stuff. One of the unusual things that happened. At 6:30 in the morning, they had a little five-minute newscast. Paul Clark was a featured voice, and what a voice he was, mm-hmm. and a great newscaster on the longer newscast, the 15 minutes. And then they had a short one at 6:30. And when one of the newscasters who wrote and read those newscasts would go on vacation, Bill Small, who was the news director, would come in and substitute for that newscaster. Bill Small was the news director of radio and television, and he wrote this five-minute newscast for me, and I look back at that, and it really is a great memory of how fluently he would write that newscast. It would just roll out
wow.
when you read it,
uh-huh.
and it was right on the money. He later became news director for one of the three major networks, both radio and television.
Oh, yeah.
He was quite a newsman.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he was also the CEO of Associated Press after he left that major.
Wow.
And last I heard of Bill Small, I don't know, I think he's still alive. He was teaching journalism at Fordham or one of the universities in New York.
And well qualified, obviously.
So I brag about the fact that a news director of high executive, both NBC and CBS, and actually was head of the whole news division for several years, used to write a little five-minute newscast for Van Vance. Now, on the, I hope people can take this as a lighter side, on the music for tonight when I did that, one time, Milton Metz was on his call-in show, which was the first one in Louisville, and he got a call from a woman. She said, "I love listening to your program, Mr. Metz, and I also listen to the station. I go to bed with Van Vance every night after he does music for tonight. I hear him sign off." So that was, we laughed about that. But anyhow, the second era for me, George Walsh liked my work. Victor A. Scholes was the manager and the man that ran WHAS mm-hmm. at that time. And George Walsh called me in and said, "We want to put you on the afternoon music show. And we're going to make a change there. And we're going to call it Funfair PM," because Jim Walton had been so successful. And he was the top personality on the station. He was the man who did the morning show, and then when they started the Crusade for Children, he was the
sure.
MC of that.
Yeah. So everybody knew.
He was the biggest name, he and Pete French, when I came mm-hmm. to HAS. They were the real big dogs, let me tell you. Ray Shelton was the voice of television.
Yeah.
So anyhow, they put me on Funfair PM. Well, we played more of easy music. We did not play rock and roll, because about that time, Wacky came into town,
so this
and they
would have
started
been,
playing
was,
rock and roll.
Late 50s, early 60s?
Yeah, early 60s, late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Wacky came in, and the rock and roll became more and more of its own identity. And so I went on the Funfair PM show. John Cunningham was my producer. He spent a lot of his workday preparing material for me to read and setting up interviews and
stuff
like
that. How did that physically work? Were you in one room, he in another, you just sat at a desk?
No, he would do all of the material and hand it to me in a manila folder, and then I would...
Did you operate the turntables and things?
No, I had engineers. I didn't touch any equipment besides turn my microphone on.
Yeah. You remember who any of the engineers were?
Yeah, at that time, most of the microphones in the big studios, when Randy Atcher and them, they had engineers that even turned them on then. Yeah. But in our little announce booths, I turned on my own microphones. A lot of our engineers had come back from World War II. They were older men, and Carl Nielsen, Butch Tune, Norman Brown, these Ken Maddox later.
And was just Harold Yarman in there? Was Harold
Yarman was one of the best. He was one of the best audio men, and did the Crusade and did the Hayloft Hoedown type shows, or did the Randy Atcher. They had a Saturday night barn dance. Just a great audio man. But anyhow, these men were the engineers, and so I related to them in the fact that they kind of helped me being a new announcer, and they were important on the afternoon program. And when I got to HAS, the engineers kind of had a rule that they would not let a record go until you gave the name of the artist and then the title. And that became pretty old when you're doing a three-hour show. So I was the first guy who began to bring in music and talk over it and time out the intros.
Yeah,
and I had an engineer or two who really worked with me, and it sounded good. The station liked it. And before long, most of the engineers were doing. Some of the old guys, the rule was, and they had a pretty good union. They, you know, we're back into that thing a little bit. They were IBEW.
Yeah. So you were one of the first guys to do that, though, talk over.
I was the first who did it.
Talk over the music.
On the 10-second intro, and then the guy would come up singing, or the lady. And one of the, like I said, we played mostly middle-of-the-road type music. And so here come the Beatles. And they're coming to the United States, and they're going to be on Ed Sullivan.
Sure.
So we played two Beatle records in particular. We played All My Loving and Michelle. Now, we didn't play Back in the USA, and we didn't play The Yellow Submarine, or some of those
we did not play. More melodic things we did, Miracle and melodic.
One of the top people on my show, Milton Matz, came in and did a weather report at 4:30, and he talked, and he was great. He was funny. We had people who wrote mail and asked us to talk about things or react to that. Uh-huh. And Kaywood would come up and do sports, he and Dave Martin. In the meantime, I was a backup sportscaster.
Let me ask you one quick. How long was your program on? What time frame?
It was on from 3 until about 6
at
that time. So anyhow, when the state tournament would come along, Kaywood would go off to the NCAA, or he'd do part of the state tournament. I did some television, high school basketball. I did the state tournament, began to work on the derby some. I wound up doing 40-some derbies. So I became identified somewhat with sports.
And you were okay with that? You enjoyed that? That was
yeah. So when I would broadcast the Sweet 16, the state tournament, the station got a lot of reaction, and I did too. People would say, hey, I heard you, I loved that game, and I would do the championship game, and they would say, why don't you go over to sports? So Kaywood even called me in a couple of times. In the meantime, he had become sports director, and George Walsh was manager of WHS Radio. And so I talked to Kaywood, but they didn't offer me much extra money. It would have been about the same thing. Here I was featured in the afternoon, so we never really got anywhere with that, or never made a final decision, and so I never switched over. So I'd go back and do my my announcing on radio and TV, and then Sam Gifford retired off of High Varieties, and he selected me to be the host of what was really their top television show of the week, an hour-long variety show for young people, a Dick Clark-type show that also had the Crusade for Children King and Queen contest and things like that. So I never made the move over, And
they were all still in the same building at this time, still at the Courier Journal building?
Right, yeah, we were still there. And one thing that happened on my music show, back in the 60s, Cassius Clay went to the Olympics, and he won a gold medal, and he came back, and he was going to be on Milton Metz's program. He was several times, and he would come in, you know, a few minutes early. One time he had made a record called Stand By Me. It was a hit by Ben E. King, I think, but he made his version of it, and he brought it with him. So I brought him in the studio about 15 minutes before he was going to go on with Milton and interviewed him, and he, we played the record.
Yeah,
But I'll never forget, when he came back from the Olympics, he was sitting in the lobby out watching TV, and he had his arms, his palms were turned upward, and he had two arms on the support of a chair support. And Larry Beck, who was a famous sports writer for the Courier Journal, was there, and Milton was there. And you look down, and Ali, of all the athletes I've ever interviewed, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, and Muhammad Ali had the most humongous forearms, just as solid as a rock.
Wow.
And Ali's were big. They're like ham hocks, practically. And Larry Beck reaches down, and he squeezes Cassius Clay. At that time, we called him Cassius. He squeezed his forearm and said, "Man, look at the forearms you got there, Cassius. How'd you get those weights?" He said, "No, man, steaks." But he was
fast with a quip, always, wasn't he?
He was quite a character. Yeah, he would go on Milton's show, and we would listen, and it was pretty fantastic broadcasting at that time. But anyhow, I stayed with the afternoon Funfair PM, and the show did pretty well, went along pretty well. And a man came to WHAS. In latter years, we got a radio manager named Hugh Barr. And WHAS radio at that time had been, like I said, a highly documentary, a great public service station. WHAS is so much a part of Kentucky and Louisville, it was unbelievable to me. I've never seen any stations that identified more with their community than our station did, and it should. Because the Binghams, when they owned that station, sometimes I said, it looks to me like our first is public service, our second is news and informing, and our third is this and that, and fourth is making money. So they did devote a lot of money and effort. The Binghams, they were not a bottom-line operation. And they became more of a bottom-line operation later
on. Necessity.
Yeah, they had to. But it was quite a unique operation, let me tell you. And so anyhow, when Hugh Barr came to WHAS.
This would have been about when did Hugh come, the middle to late 60s, somewhere along in there?
The middle, more in the 60s. It was in the 60s. When he came to WHAS, he changed the station. He brought it into the modern era of broadcasting. Well, we began to go all music because of the budget and this, that.
And he was the program director of WHAS, or the manager?
And the manager.
Okay.
He came in and took over both jobs, you might say. He hired Wayne Perkey. He hired eventually Jack Fox.
Eventually, yeah.
He hired Dave McCree and later Joe Donovan. The morning Wayne Perkey and recordings, and we began to do more stuff like traffic and more emphasis on weather. Dick Gilbert type.
Traffic with a traffic
and,
cop.
And Hugh Barr was a stickler for the sound that went on the air. He believed in a little bit of reverb and echo, and he had weekly meetings. He had your programs recorded. He'd call you in and do critiques on your work every week. And
would it be fair to say that just before Hugh came, radio had been very prominent, but it kind of almost taken a side, a lower step than television. Television had come on and become very prominent by that time. Is that right? Or maybe other stations, the Wackies and KLOs had come on and had taken the radio thunder. Is that basically
It was a changing business. Yeah. The teenagers had gone with the rock and roll stations, and it began to fracture.
They wanted more than Michelle.
Right. Yeah, they did. But anyhow, Hugh Barr, it's amazing. He set the whole foundation for WHAS radio of what it was actually for the next almost 20 years or more. In fact, when I retired from WHAS in 99, either through some of the personnel still there, and a lot of the tendencies and things they were doing on the air were still remnants of Q Bar.
Wow.
Established.
So he kind of carved out a new identity for the radio station.
Right, that he did, and put it more or less, made it a modern era type broadcast.
Still community oriented and all
right,
that sort of thing.
Yeah. And he went for a little different type. In the old days, we were announcers, and mm-hmm. we were a little more formal and this and that, so it was a changing. But that was my...
Well, how were you involved in that? What did you do?
Well, Hugh, I had gone off of the afternoon show, but he came in, and not long after he was there, he brought me back and put me back in the afternoon drive.
Okay.
So a man named Ed Shadburn, who had put Channel 32, WLKY, on television here, mm-hmm. Was hired by the Binghams to run WHAS radio and television. And Ed Shadburn heard me do the state tournament, and he stopped me, and he said, you know, we're getting a lot of good reaction to your sports work. And he said, I know you're a personality, and you're playing music, and you're on in the afternoon. He said, basically, that's a young man's game. There's going to come a time that you're probably not going to be the man to be doing that. I think you ought to be in sports full time, and that would be a longer career for mm-hmm. you and this and that. And I said, well, Ed, they've talked to me. Kaywood has talked to me about that before, but they've never offered me enough money or anything to persuade me to go over there. He said, well, let me talk to Kaywood. We'll see if we can work something out. Well, I kind of felt bad because I was very loyal to Hugh Barr, and I liked working for him, one of the not only a great radio executive, but just a very fine human being.
Mm, yeah. Mm.
So anyhow, Kaywood called me in, and really it was like you'd almost have to go to another station or change markets. I had a new career all of a sudden in salary status and everything
else. So you would be working for radio or television at this point? Radio?
I'd be working for sports. I became full-time sports.
Okay.
Which was both radio and television.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. So about a month or two after I went to full-time sports, we landed the Kentucky Colonels.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Contract, which had been on WAVE and Ed Calvay.
Which was an American Basketball Association pro team.
So within a month and a half or 2 months, here I am, a pro broadcaster.
Wow, that's a big step.
Which started in September. Mm-hmm. And that was even another boost financially because every time I did a basketball game, I got a talent fee for that.
Yeah.
And boy, they play a lot of games in the pros.
They do, yeah.
Including the playoffs, which the first year we went to the seventh and deciding playoff game in Salt Lake City, Utah. I did 100 and some basketball games
that year.
And here a kid that grew up playing basketball all of his life.
Was great.
What else could you ask?
Who were some of the stars at that time in the ABA that you remember?
Well, my year, we landed the contract the year that Dan Issel and Mike Pratt signed with the Kentucky Colonels.
That would have been what, about 19...
1970-71.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Gene Rhodes was the coach, but they let him go. That was a lot of controversy, and hired Frank Ramsey. And we went to the seventh and deciding championship game and lost to the Utah Stars out in Salt Lake City.
Frank Ramsey had been a star at UK years ago, and then with the Boston
Celtics.
Yeah, and then the Boston Celtics.
So anyhow, that was the beginning of a new era for me, working in sports with Kaywood Ledford. And I was kind of... The Kentucky Colonel play-by-play, he did the UK, and then we did the radio and TVs. We had a guy named Walt Adams who also worked with us, and we had a photographer. And then Patty was our secretary. She was the farm and sports secretary mm-hmm. at the time at the station. And I loved it. I mean, I had a great career, but I was working like 7 days a week. The pros, we would travel all over the country. I might be in Louisville today, in New York tonight, in Dallas tomorrow, and 2 days later in San Diego later
on. Some experiences, though, didn't you? Wow.
Yeah, travel around the world. I tell people I've been around the world twice and spoken to everybody once.
Well, now, that was during the bad. What about in the off season? Was there off-season?
There wasn't much. The first year, I was not able to work on the Derby a couple of years as much as I wanted to. I worked during Derby week because I was We were still in the playoffs in the ABA. Mm-hmm. The day Secretariat won the Kentucky Derby, the Colonels and the Pacers were featured on CBS television that day, one of the championship games up in Indianapolis. Dan Issel and I drive back to a restaurant in south of Indianapolis, turn on WHAS and listen to Secretariat winning the Derby, broadcast by Kaywood.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was really a busy sportsman, let me tell you that.
So you, it was, but it was all Colonels at that point, basically. You didn't have time to do much else, did you?
That's right. No, but I did do this. I remember one time I got on an airplane, American Airliner, in the morning in San Diego, because they're 2 hours behind us, or 3 hours behind us out there. I started early morning in San Diego, and I flew into Louisville and did the 10:15 sports on radio that night.
Oh, my goodness.
With all the jet lag that goes with it at that same time.
Wow.
But so I go along until 1975, and one of the unusual things about being the voice of the Kentucky Colonels that was very enjoyable, I had both Louisville Cardinals and Kentucky Colonels on my basketball team.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Kentucky Wildcats and the Louisville Cardinals.
On the Colonels team.
So the fans, both UK and the Louisville fans, loved Van Vance because I was for both of them.
Sure.
You know, they identified me with Dan Issel, Louis Dampier, with Ron Thomas, Alan Murphy. When I became the voice of the Louisville Cardinals, I lost a lot of the UK
fans
in latter years, even though, and my last 2 years of doing the Kentucky Colonels in Kentucky sports, if you did the Kentucky Wildcats for being sportscaster of the year, you had it whipped. I mean, 1 year Kaywood told me, he said, Van, this year I won. Ralph Hacker, my color man, was second. And John Ferguson, he was just the guy down on the field who said on a field goal or when they flipped a coin, it's heads, Kentucky won the toss, or the field goal is good. He came in third in Sportscaster of the Year.
And here's Van doing all these games.
But anyhow, in 75 and 76, I won Sportscaster of the Year because some of the Lexington writers and broadcasters voted for me. When I became the voice of the Cardinals,
they didn't vote
I wasn't
for you
getting
anymore.
Any votes out of Lexington.
When
and
that
was
happen?
Kind of funny. Kaywood and I would laugh about that. That was 75 and 76. The Colonels was their final year.
Okay.
So they leave, and John Y does not go into the NBA. And I'm Van Vance is a man without a team.
Yeah.
I kept telling people, I'm going to do Sullivan Business College next year. So anyhow, in 1978, Ed Shadburn had come there, and he's trying to get the U of L contract. He'd been trying to get it ever since he came to WHAS. And we finally landed it in 1978 for television. But I only did like 7 or 8 games on Channel 11.
Yeah.
Not enough to really even get your style.
But you're still working at WHAS.
Yeah, and I'm doing basic sports. And then I began to work with Gary Burbank. We'll talk more about him in the afternoon and people like that. So finally, in 1981-82, the year after Reed hit the long shot and beat Louisville when they were defending champs, that next season I started doing the University of Louisville. Mm-hmm. Wound up going to the Final Four in New Orleans in the Superdome. We lost to Georgetown. Then in 1983, went to Albuquerque, and we lost to the Slamma Jammas after leading them by 15 points.
That was Houston?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in 1986, 3 of the first 5 years I did U of L, I went to the Final Four. I said, this is easy.
Yeah.
There's nothing to this. In 86, we won it all in Dallas Reunion.
Yeah.
And let me say this about Coach Denny Crum. Do you realize that Louisville was the basketball team of the 80s in the NCAA? You realize what Denny Crum did in the state of Kentucky. He came in here, he surpassed the UK basketball program during that decade, although they won the championship in 78 under Joe Hall. I'm not taking anything away from them. But the only time that Louisville has surpassed UK and won those championships was during Denny Crum's era.
Yeah.
And you look back on that now, since 86 they haven't won one at the time we're making this interview. It's pretty amazing what he did.
Yeah, yeah. And a gentleman, too. Great guy.
A great man to work with, and I can't say enough about him overall. He was just so. I have been involved with three of the major sports teams and universities in the state. I worked in Bowling Green, went to school at Western, played basketball, went to UK, worked in Lexington, and attended university, and then my association with the University of Louisville went on for...
legendary coaches. Diddle, Adolf Rupp was at Kentucky when you were there, and then Denny Crum. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And then came and worked with Denny Crum here in Louisville as well.
Mm-hmm.
But those were... I mean, I tell people that I had the greatest career and the best life that anybody could ever have. With all that I went through and then winning the NCAA in 1986, but it became very difficult to get back. I never went to another Final Four.
Did you tell me the 19 was at 82 in New Orleans? That was the first Superdome, Final Four in the Superdome.
Yeah, it was an unbelievable scene there. Around 70,000 people in that gigantic edifice, and Kentucky's just won it this year, and I'm looking at pictures of that. And I'd forgotten how immense a span that is inside. And I'll never forget, there were fans up in those higher rise. There's no way they could see the game. Now they have big screens up there for them.
Back then they didn't. No.
And I looked up, and there were two coveys of pigeons flying around in the top of the dome. Those were my highlights. The Colonels winning the ABA in 1975. Working with Hubie Brown, Dan Issel, Artis Gilmore, and then, of course, Denny Crum and the Cardinals winning it all at Reunion in the year 1986. And those are great memories, let me tell you.
You had you didn't have a color person with the ABA games. Did you have the Colonels?
I did on television. On the television reports, an ex-player, Walt Simon, worked with me.
Played for the Colonels.
Yeah, and he had come back here and was working for Kentucky Fried Chicken and those organizations that owned that, and was a great guy, Walt, and was a good color man, but he only worked with me on television game.
But on the U of L games, radio, you had...
I started with Jack Tennant. He was a great guy.
He was a U of L guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was an assistant athletic director. And then later on, I worked with Jock Sutherland, and later I'm going to talk about some of the people with whom I worked, and so we'll come back to Jock. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But anyhow, I wound up my career at WHAS basically broadcasting sports. I did around 42 derbies. I did the Fiesta Bowl, which up until Louisville won the Orange Bowl, was the highlight of the whole beating
comeback.
Alabama. Yeah, that was an unbelievable time.
Howard Schnellenberger was the coach.
Right. Best coached football team for that one game I've ever seen. I was a host on a sports talk program, which they put on the air back around 1982. And during that Fiesta Bowl, hoopla, all of that, our telephones would start ringing at 6 o'clock. We didn't even go on the air until 7.
Mm.
And the phones it was one of the most hectic, interesting times for
sports
talk.
Did you do the first sports talk program in the evening there?
It was done in Louisville when it started. In
the 70s there.
Right. And
how long did you do that, Van? For several years.
I did it until 1996. 95, 96.
I'll tell you one great story. I remember that. I have a lot of stories, but I remember one time a guy calling up and said, "Van, I like your program, and I love all the big, but I wish y'all give the wrestling results." If you remember this or not, and Van said, "Well, I'm sorry, but you know, some people think they already know who's going to win." And the guy said, "Well, maybe they do, but I don't. I'd like to hear them anyway." It's a classic.
Well, I had a lot of unusual things happen on that sports talk program. Basically, the popularity of that program was built on basketball and on basketball recruiting.
Yeah, football was not particularly big around here
Not for that, because we just weren't winning that many games,
either
Kentucky or nor Louisville. But one of the great sports administrators in the history of Louisville, I have to say that Bill Olson, Mike Storin, who ran the Kentucky Colonels, and A. Ray Smith, of the three sports executives with whom I worked.
A. Ray was with. Yeah. A. Ray was with.
Ran the Redbirds, owned them and brought them and had a million people year attend the minor league games.
Out of the old stadium there at the fairgrounds.
I had A. Ray on my sports talk one night, and he said, "Who you got on your program tomorrow night?" And I said, "Well, A. Ray, I've got, I'm open line. I don't have a guest tomorrow night." And he said, "How'd you like to have Keith Hernandez?" Well, at that time, Keith Hernandez had won the National League Most Valuable Player Award with the St. Louis Cardinals. I said, "Are you kidding me?" He said, "No, he's coming to see me tomorrow. You like to have him on your show?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "What time you want him down here?" And I said, 7:05 till 9. He said, "Well, my chauffeur will deliver him right here to the studio for you at 7:05. So Keith Hernandez comes in, a great guy, and this beautiful young girlfriend came with him and sat in the studio. And we're talking a lot of calls coming in. We're talking a lot about baseball and sports. And at about 8:30 at night, I get a call. I said, "Van, yeah, this is Jimmy Jesse over in Cynthiana, Kentucky. How do you think your Cats are going to do next year?" Crack me up. It's hard to get away from basketball.
That's right. Get those basketballs.
But one time, Louisville and Kentucky were going to the Final Four or were winning a lot in the NCAA. But I would bring Jim Strader on and talk hunting and fishing in particular. I would bring Larry Nektar on and talk NASCAR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we were way ahead of our time on NASCAR. And I took a lot of beating from management and from those basketball fans. They didn't like it when I put Strader or put the NASCAR on a night or two because they wanted to hear that basketball every night, even during the summer.
Yeah.
The recruiting. So you didn't have the internet then. So one night a guy calls me up and he said, "Van, when are you going to get back to talking about what got you where you are?" Because I knew what he meant. He wanted to go back to the basketball.
That's funny.
But that show had, of course, it had the Rick Pitino coaches show or Denny Crum, Howard Schnellenberger, Bill Curry, the different coaches as they came along. They also were featured on certain nights on that show.
Well, Van, you've had 42 years at WHAS. That's several eras there, too. And you've had a lot of people that have been just legends here in Kentucky broadcasting that you've had the opportunity to work with. You've had influence on some of them, and some of them had influence on you. Who are some of those people?
Well, of course, I mentioned Jim Walton, who was kind of Mr. WHAS when I went there, a man that I always admired. Idolize him as Milton Metz. It was great to work alongside Milton and to know him and play tennis with him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was quite a competitor, and he is just an identity with HAS that he came there in the 40s. I don't know if you realize that, but he was there for a long time.
And when you were on with Sports Talk, your program butted right up to his.
Right, and so he and I talked to one another. We went on trips together. He went along on some of the basketball Final Four trips to broadcast, especially in 83 when the Dream Game was played. He and I broadcast live down in Knoxville from the hotel. Milton Metz is, you only meet one like him in a lifetime. And you only meet one like Terry Miners and Jock Sutherland in a lifetime, and Gary Burbank. A lot of people say, "How was your job? Did you like your work?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I spent half of my job or my life laughing at Gary Burbank, Terry Miners, and Jock Sutherland." That's not a job. That's not work.
That's fun, huh?
That's enjoying
it. So when Burbank and Miners were on, you did sports on their program.
Yeah, Gary Burbank.
It went way beyond that, didn't it?
Yeah, it sure did.
You became a character on both their programs.
Yeah, Gary Burbank started the Van Vance School of Dance. And then the Burt Lance High School of Finance when Jimmy Carter was president, and he carried on all of that stuff. And then Terry Miners came on, and he had double V's. People still say, "Hey, double V's."
Right,
or they call me Van Line. The only thing that sticks to it is love.
And that was a Terry Miners.
Yeah, he had about 14 nicknames for me, including Mojo. That's a phrase that I kind of started with him.
Uh-huh.
And he would play. He's got his mojo working when I would come on. So Terry Miners. And the thing with Terry Miners is when we were on the air, there was no announcing. It was nothing fake. That was just the way it was.
You just talked.
Yeah, it was.
Among other things.
It was real life. Of course, I mentioned Hugh Barr and how important he is in the history of WHAS radio. Jock Sutherland was quite an individual with whom to work. Jock, I've laughed at him so much. One time we went to New York, and he called the New York subway an outhouse on wheels, was his term for it.
Now, what was Jock's background? He played basketball. He coached.
He played at Lafayette for Ralph Carlisle, and then he finally coached at Lafayette, and then he won the state tournament in 1979.
And he coached in the college ranks, too, didn't he?
Yeah, he became an assistant to C.M. Newton down at the University of Alabama and recruited the first black player there, who later became head of the dormitory that he moved in by the time he was a senior, young player named Hunter. But Jock was certainly one of the most unusual individuals I ever met.
Great sense of humor.
And we had a sports talk program that used to get quite controversial. And one year, the telephones would start ringing when Jock was going to be on at 6 in the evening for a 7 o'clock program. He came in one night early in the year, and Kentucky had a powerhouse. They had Bowie, they had Turpin, they had Minifield and Master, and I think Charles Hurt on that team. And he said, if Kentucky doesn't win the NCAA this year, they ought to turn Rupp Arena into a skating rink.
Oh, my goodness.
You don't think get the telephone call. And, of course, I'm trying to be an objective sportscaster.
That was the days you would do that.
Yeah, and trying to play it down the middle. At the same time, I was the voice of the U of L Cards. But I had a lot of Kentucky background and the history of Kentucky basketball. I knew a lot about it from the time I grew up. So I tried to be objective, and later I brought Jim Master and Billy Donovan on to kind of give a balance up the Kentucky angle. But he was one of a kind, Jock Sutherland is. He told me one time, he said, it's really great to come to Louisville where they show me five fingers, in Lexington they only show me one. So I could tell you stories about Jock Sutherland all day long. Yeah. He told somebody about me one time. He said, that guy Vance over there, he may look like the rest of us, but he's really from another planet, he said. But and I wanted to say some great things about Wayne Perkey. Hugh Barr brought him to WHAS and gave him the morning show, and he became a fixture in Louisville.
30 years, yeah.
Yeah, top ratings, and just his enthusiasm, his attitude, and the way he treated the people with whom he worked. I cannot say that I ever met a finer guy in broadcasting or a very fine broadcaster. I used to have a little trouble with Wayne when he would go on trips with me in the NCAA. I would do his engineering, set up his equipment. He would use my basketball equipment. I set him up in Hawaii. But his enthusiasm when I would be on with him sometimes, I had to. It was hard to keep up with him, you know. I guess you worked with him and you know that Wayne really was into his job and his work.
Yeah, loved it.
He's one of a kind who came along here in Louisville. So there have been many of them that I loved working with them and appreciated my career. The people who affected me overall were Shadburn, Kaywood Ledford. The thing I loved about Kaywood Ledford when I went to work for him at WHAS, I won the only time just about he never won it. In 75 and 76, I won the Sportscaster of the Year award. Uh-huh. So I went down to North Carolina to accept it, and Dave Kindred had won the Sports Writer of the Year award.
He was in the Courier-Journal at the time.
And so Dave is down there, and he said, you know, I talked to Kaywood about you, and he is real complimentary of your work. He said, you're top of the line. Now, here's a guy that really, in a way, we were competing, even though we worked together, and he said good things about me like that. Well, there was a time that Kaywood, we ran into a little controversy one time of what they wanted me to do on the air, which would have taken me off the Kentucky Colonels. And I didn't want to do that. I had an identity and I had a job there, but there was some things going on. And he said, Van, I agree with you. That would be a bad decision. And he said, if you feel that way, I'll go to the top front office and you and I will go as a group. He said, me doing UK and you doing the Colonels we're a major part of this radio station. We're billing around $500,000 a year for WHS Radio. And if you and I don't want to do it, I don't think they're going to make us do it.
Wow.
So he had a two-way loyalty. He was not only loyal to the company, but he was also loyal to his employees.
That's a big thing, yeah.
And it really impressed me. One thing about Kaywood, he wrote several books. He loved to write. He would sit in that office in there and plan his books and what he was going to write. And even though he was on TV and radio, he loved to write his books and the things that he used in broadcasting. Yeah. When I first came to HAS, I worked the state tournament with George Walsh, and he had been a writer and was of the writer era. You will not believe what George Walsh did. Let's say Lafayette is playing Atherton in the championship game of the Kentucky High School Basketball Tournament. George Walsh, before he went on the air, would write a closing to that game in case Atherton won or in case Lafayette won, whichever team won or lost. Now, of course, in latter days, we didn't do anything like that. But that's how thorough or how much writing was still important in broadcasting when I first came to WHAS. Wow. A lot of that had been caused by a guy named Jimmy Finnegan, who had been a sports writer and who had worked at WHAS as a radio and television sportscaster.
I remember that name.
Jimmy Finnegan, he had a lot of expressions. He'd say, "Now, in case you need me for anything, my name is Jimmy Finnegan. So long, everybody." He had a lot of favorite expressions like that. But
did he do some television too in the early days?
He sure did.
And I remember as a kid, Van, living in Western Kentucky in Henderson County.
Right.
One of the first television. This is in the early 50s. One of the first television sets in that little town, gathering around all the kids on Saturday night. That antenna going out snowy. But I remember Jimmy Finnegan being on
Well, they brought Jimmy Finnegan back for Sunday night television football scoreboard. They decided to put on a program about 10:30 at night or 11:30. See, we had the 10 o'clock news in the old days, so I don't know, remember if it was still 10 or 11. And they wanted him... Jimmy Finnegan was brought in to produce Paul Hornung. Hornung had never done radio and television, even though he had retired from the NFL. And Paul was pretty bad when he first started, because here he walks into a studio taking signals and having to do a 15-minute sports scoreboard and all of that with some tape film. And Jimmy Finnegan was put in charge of that to break Paul in, to set him up and school him and be his mentor. And that's the last time I remember Jimmy working in radio and TV. But Jimmy Finnegan was, at one time, did the 5:15 and the 10:15 on WHAS radio. He did those two sportscasts, and every word was written out.
How about that?
And the announcer had to do one-liners leading into his stories, you know?
Wow, wow.
And one time he had a headline that said, "Austin Myler breaks 4-minute mile," Aussie Myler, and that was Roger Bannister or somebody. And the announcer who did the lead in said, "Aussie Miller breaks 4-minute mile." But that was Jimmy Finnegan. Jack, it's been great to talk about WHAS. It's a great station, always has been and always will be. But we've had some great people and some great events there.
Your 42 years was a great contribution.
In the old days, the Crusade for Children, live from the state fair, the state tournament, the Kentucky Derby.
Anything happening, the station was there.
That's right. And originally, the Derby was one-day event. Then it became a week event. And now it's, a two-month event. All right.
Thanks, Van. Van Vance.